Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. Today on the show, I have the managing partner at the Flourishing Leadership Institute out of Cleveland, Mr. John Berghoff. His story is amazing. His insight is one of a kind. So I thought I'd give you a little bit of a snippet today.
And somebody said, they said, you know, the reason that you're doing what you're doing is because you're ultimately, you're redeeming your soul from your past. I thought, oh my gosh, that sounds deep. I need to go sit with that and figure out what they're actually talking about. But as I thought about it, it reminded me of so many of my peers and my friends who are entrepreneurs of all different types, who I've all heard them say the same thing, that so much of what they eventually got themselves into was just to heal themselves of some challenge that they had of their own.
And there you go. That is Mr. John Berghoff. Listen, if you want the full-length interview, go to my website at www.drjameskelly.com. It's Dr. James, K-E-L-L-E-Y. com to listen to John and I talk about fatherhood, parenting styles, his other jobs, the fact that John was a Cutco knife guru around the world. He's in the Hall of Fame. Also want to remind you to please go to my website, and I want to hear from you in your adversity moments when you change your leadership style. And finally, I want to say thanks to C-Suite Partners, as well as go leave a review on iTunes. All right, everyone, have a wonderful day. See you.
All right. On today's episode of Executives After Hours, I have the pleasure to talk with Mr. John Berghoff. Berghoff.
Yeah, you know, I've somebody pointed out to me recently that even I do not consistently pronounce it the same way. So that says something about me, and I should go find out what.
And that's why you're here. it's probably Berghoff.
Yeah, I think that's the correct full pronunciation, is to pronounce the H. But in my efforts to be efficient, I think I ditch the H at times.
Well, I think efficiency is a positive thing. And you're actually the managing partner at the Flourishing Institute, which we'll talk about that in a little bit. And what this method is in terms of what you guys do. I mean, you've sucked me into it completely. You know, just to kind of give my audience a bit of a backdrop, you know, John and I talked last Wednesday, as a fact, as I was driving up to Dubai, and I got off the phone with you, did my little radio show, and got in the car, got back the next morning, because my wife was in bed when I got back, and I said, I got my new thing that I'm doing. I had to explain to her what it was, but my wife did say, and we'll get to this in a second. She was like, yeah. "But didn't you tell me he was like a ninja for selling Cutco knives?" I was like, yeah. And she goes, "Did he just sell you?" I was like, "I think so." That's all right. Anyhow, yeah. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, thank you, Dr. James, Jim. Appreciate it, buddy. Glad to be here.
Just not asshole, please. All right. So all right, John. So, you know, what I like to do historically is if you can kind of quickly give me the 10,000 foot view of where you're at and what you do.
Yeah. Well, I right now, here's the ground level view. I'm in Hudson, Ohio, and I grew up in Cupertino, California. Hudson is just outside of Cleveland. So, it's very different from where I grew up. I'm a father of three young kids. I'm married to my beautiful wife, Mara. And, you know, I start by answering that question by telling you that I'm a dad because as passionate as I am and committed to what I'm doing in my professional work, having kids in the last 7 years, and I know you could probably relate in some way, and you actually met two of my older two kids recently, which was cool. Yeah. But for me, at least, having kids, you know, was kind of a wake up to give me, not that I lacked purpose, but a renewal and a whole new perspective on purpose. So when I think about who I am and what I do, you know, my kids are really the first thing that comes to mind, and everything kind of shows up after that. So I don't know if that's I don't know if that helps at all, but that's the first way I think about who I am. Yeah.
Well, I think what's great about that, though, is that usually when I ask that question, people define their career first. And their family usually about minute 35 when I ask the questions. So what I do like about that is that you really define yourself by the family that you've created with your wife. But beyond that, you're the managing partner at Flourishing Institute. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. We're a consulting and research firm, and we our mission and our purpose is to continually search, to continually find answers to a question. And that question is, what is it that brings out the best in any human system, which is our silly way of talking about any group of people, a team, a community, an organization, a city, a region, a society at large. And so that's our purpose and our mission. It's to figure out what brings out the best in groups of people. And, you know, the way we live that out, as you alluded to it a second ago, we have an approach to designing and facilitating conversations, certain types of conversations that help groups of people to kind of tap into their collective potential, and which those sounds like a lot of buzzwords. So I usually would want to clarify what that actually means. But yeah, that's the high level of who we are at Flourishing Leadership Institute.
So, well, let's talk about that. So how old were you when you had your first job?
I was 12. I'm sure we were violating some sort of labor laws. I was into golf, and my parents didn't belong to any particular club. So I had another buddy of mine who was into golf, and we both went to this course that we liked to play at, but it was expensive to play there. And we couldn't convince our parents to keep paying for us to play at this place. So we came up with a plan, and we wrote a letter to the manager and asked him, we said, give us the worst job that nobody wants, and we'll do it in exchange for free golf. And he's like, great. So they, so they had this shitty driving range where it wasn't a full range. It was like a partial, like 50 yards long, just a net that people would hit golf balls into. And it was a total pain in the ass to scrape the golf balls out of the grass. You had to do it with this rake that would get stuck every 5 feet. So we quickly realized we certainly were fulfilling the worst possible job on this golf course. So we had to pick up these golf balls and then drive them up a hill. That was the best part, is at 12, we're driving the golf cart. Yeah. Probably weren't supposed to. And then as we get them up to the top of the hill, and then we had to wash the golf balls by hand. So it is not an exaggeration to say that for 5 years, my first job was scrubbing dirty balls. And that's where it all started. But I had a hell of a work ethic that I think I got from my parents, and I really admired how hard they worked. And so
what did they do? Like, what did your parents do?
Well, growing up, they were both in the tech industry. My parents met working together at Intel in the 70s. And my mom was a project manager for Cisco for years, and then 3M. And my dad worked for Siemens for almost 25 years. And then he went on to, he's still in the LED business, but he was in semiconductor. For I don't know what 20, 25 years. And then my mom, I really admire her because she growing up, my parents both worked full time in that, you know, incredible part of the world where there's this like pioneering sense of spirit. And even as a kid, not really knowing what they did for work, I could feel and sense that pioneering spirit. And then my mom, when she was in her 50, maybe late 40s. I got to get the timeline straight, but she left an entire career in the tech space, went back to school to get her master's, to then go teach kids English as a second language. And I just had so much respect for that, to at that stage in her life, to, you know, go back to the drawing board and say, whoa, would give me a sense of purpose right now. So that was how I grew up with my parents.
Well, I feel like you just kind of just basically we're done with the podcast at this point. So thanks, John Berghoff, for stopping by. So I think there's a lot of things to unpack in that whole thing, just about yourself. So you're the youngest of three.
That's right.
You have two older brothers, and you have parents who, by all accounts, are super driven and successful. Right? Is that
sure? Yeah. I mean, you could buy, you know, some standards of success, but
sure. And we can define that 100 different ways.
To tomorrow.
Yeah. So, but traditional, I guess how you would define it. So,
yeah.
You know, did both your parents go to college?
Yeah, my dad went to college. My mom, I think she took a long time to get her undergraduate, and then her, you know, went back to get her graduate degree. She went to college. It's crazy that I don't even know. Berkeley. She went to Berkeley. Mm. At some point, she might listen to this and correct me. She's like, I didn't go to Berkeley. Whatever. My dad went to college in Minnesota, where he grew up. He had four brothers and a sister. So his mom raised, wait, is that right? Four? No, he had three brothers and a sister. So, and they were all born within a pretty close period of time. So I've got a lot of respect for his mom for raising those kids close together. So that's where they grew up. Yeah.
So the reason why I asked this question is that, and did your brothers go to college as well?
So one of my brothers went to college and the other did not. And in fact, my older brother, he lived kind of a textbook journey. If you were to pursue a path of education to lead to become an incredible leader in the business world, he went to UC Davis for an undergraduate degree and then Stanford for a PhD in aeronautics and space robotics. And he was the fastest in the history of their program. He did it in like 2 years. And then he got an MBA at UCLA. And now I think he rules the world. I don't really know. And then my other brother, you know, barely fumbled his way through high school. And what was interesting is I was actually kind of like between them. I was actually more like my other brother, where I struggled more for social reasons and psychological reasons. So every college that I applied to, I was rejected from for undergraduate. And then like 12 years later, I got accepted into a great executive MBA program. And then I started teaching there before I was done with the program. So my relationship with education is very interesting because I got passionate about learning. But the traditional system didn't work very well for me.
So what do you mean by saying that you had psychological and like just social problems? Because if you're such a social person and you're a great storyteller and super athletic and kind of like what you would typically think is like the cool kid on campus, so to speak.
Yeah. You know, I've never really totally dissected what was the root cause of why I struggled when I was in high school. You know, it was the simple answer, and I know there's something deeper to it, which let's just go there. Let's get it. you know, the simple answer, but I've come to realize how big of a deal this is our family moved a couple of times. And so I was in kind of three different schools in sixth grade and then seventh and eighth and then high school. And, you know, for me at least, that was a time in my life where it was really tricky to have to reestablish a whole new social network and relationships at those ages. And so maybe it's just my excuse, but I remember in high school, it was a little tough because I was around a lot of folks that all had these relationships and I didn't. So I always had this story in my head that, okay, I'm already behind. And then for probably deeper reasons, I just, you know, had insecurities that I lived with. I'm a pretty big introvert. And so I think there's some sort of cocktail there, a recipe for disaster when, because of just practical reasons, I don't have a strong peer network, combined with, I think, insecurity of being 15 and 16, combined with being an introvert. That was like the ultimate formula for disaster. And then there was a kind of a seminal moment in high school where I remember the kids I was friends with, you know, we were all getting into trouble in our own way. And I remember I had a little voice in my head that wasn't excited about how far some of my friends were going to, you know, risk getting in trouble. And so there was this moment where the kids who I was becoming friends with, we kind of separated, and where I kind of had nobody. And so I actually remember, and actually Susan Cain wrote a book called Quiet about introverts. And I met her years ago, and I'm like a case study in her book. And she writes about it because she interviewed me that I, in high school, I literally junior, senior year, I just like sat in the library by myself and read some books and like at lunchtime when everybody else was socializing. And you might
not play sports.
You know, I played golf and soccer. But at that time I was, I got out of some of the sports I was in, and then I got saved. I was saved when I was working at that golf course, and a buddy of mine who was working there said, he was showing me his paycheck because he had this job selling Cutco kitchen knives. And he said, "Can I come sell knives to your mom?" And I said, "Sure." And I watched him sell knives to my mom in a really, you know, high integrity way. Like, he just presented a great product, and I followed him out the door, and I said, "How much money did you just make selling knives to my mom?" And he showed me the number on his calculator, and I said, "Holy shit." And I quit my golf job the next day, and I said, "I got to go find out how to sell knives." And I got saved by this company that has an incredible culture. And that was like a huge turn. Our mutual friend, Christopher, you know, he would call that it was a way out of a bad situation in life. And I can point back to mentors and lessons at that pivotal time that really just turned things around for me.
So, all right, let's talk about Cutco a little bit, because, you know, I know that this was a transformational point in your life. And so how old were you when you started selling Cutco knives?
I was 17. It was the summer between my junior and senior year in high school.
And so walk me through this process for you deciding to go down this path.
Yeah. Well, as I said earlier, you know, my buddy had introduced me to it. And when I first showed up to the interview, and then, you know, I got hired, and so I show up to training. And I remember in training, I'm sitting there thinking, I had a number of thoughts in my head. And one of them was, well, I just left that golf course job that I'd been there for 5 years, but my manager at that place was an asshole. You know, he was the kind of guy who we don't know if he actually had a normal speaking tone of voice. He only yelled at us. So on one hand, I had been looking for my escape. On the other hand, it was 5 years, right, where you build up, you know, a sense of certainty and consistency. So I remember sitting in training thinking, oh my gosh, what if I don't sell anything? Right. So I had that thought. And then I remember my manager, a guy named Dan Cassetta, who he was my first, you know, mentor as an entrepreneur, although my parents were really my first mentors indirectly through how they lived life. And my mom, by the risks that she took, and my dad through witnessing how he had taught me to learn something from everything. But then Dan, I'll never forget. There I am, 17 years old, questioning if this was the right idea. And one of the things that really turned on a light bulb for me is he's said something like, he said, you know, life doesn't get any easier. And remember, this was at a time in my life where I was wishing it would get easier. He said, life doesn't get easier. He said, what happens is you get better. Your skills get better. You change. Life doesn't change.
I love that.
Yeah. I was 17. Now, keep in mind, he was about 30 at the time, and he was kind of already a self-made, financially free guy in the history of their companies. He was one of their, probably the top manager out of hundreds and hundreds that had ever been there. And that was fortune, fate, luck, whatever you want to call it, that he was the that I started in. And then the next thing he said, James, you really drilled it home, because I'm looking at the life that he's created for himself and others who had found a way to succeed selling these kitchen knives. And the next thing he says is, he goes, you know, your income, because I'm still a 17-year-old guy, you know, driven by pretty materialistic things. And he said, your income is never, it's never going to exceed the level at which you develop yourself. And I just remember thinking, what if he's right about all this? Because if he is, I ought to try it out, because what I'm doing right now is not working. And then, so that was kind of where the switch flipped. And over the next few months, I got as close as I could to the wisdom that Dan would pass along to me. And then, the next few years I just flourished, and that just set off a path of learning and entrepreneurship that, I'm supremely grateful for.
I mean, and that's what I was going to say, is that, you know, by the phrase that you just used the words you just used by saying, I got as close as I could to him. It seems to me that you are someone who's probably very fairly highly coachable if the respect is in order.
I don't know if I'm coachable as much as I'm curious. And actually, maybe they go one and the same. I think curiosity plus some sort of humility, which those all go together, I guess, lead to coachability. But I got that from, at that point in time, from Dan. And I'll give you an example. You know, here he was. He had every reason to believe that he had all the answers for me. And he did. He taught me a lot that lives with me every second of every day still, you know, whatever it is, 20 years later. However, he also sent me out to learn from others. He sent me when I was 17 to go learn from a Tony Robbins coach. I ended up hiring a guy for $500 a month because I was making just enough money selling the knives. I could actually afford that. But here it's an interesting situation where Dan.
But wait, how did you know though? Right. This is the shit I find fascinating. Is how did you know at 17, your head from your ass to say, you know what, I'm going to hire this guy over here to transform me? Because I think that's a really insightful, mature thing to do for someone who's typically, not you per se, but someone who's typically not mature at 17.
Well, it's one of the beautiful things about business and entrepreneurship, and more specifically sales, is what I was able to see really clearly was, okay, being in sales is actually a really nice reflection, and this was my opinion, of life. In that, and I remember sharing this with you with Christopher, and you didn't like my choice of words, but maybe in context, you'll actually appreciate the point. And that, you know, somebody had said to me early on in sales that, you know, in sales, you don't get paid based on, well, obviously clocking in and out, right? You get paid based on what you earn. And ultimately, you don't get paid based on what you want to make, what you need to make. You get paid based on what you deserve, based on the value that you create. And I just remember, for me, I felt like I saw a really clear connection. I thought, well, that must be how the world works. There must be some truth to that. So why was I attracted to hire a coach? Because I could read a book, or I could get an idea and then go apply it minutes later and see how it could directly impact my income. And that's, you know, when you're in a commission-based sales situation, you have that benefit of, I can learn something and then go apply it right away and see what happens. So that was part of why I think it was clear for me that, okay, I'm going to keep learning in this area.
But I still think that shows a higher level of intellect at that age, because shit, at 43, I feel like I'd have a hard time doing that. So, like, you know, for me, you know, maybe that's my own personal bias, because I think at like 18, 19, I quit university for a year and I sold cars. I sold new and used Chevrolets, and I think I started doing that, like, I want to say, I guess it was April when I was 19, it's like April, somewhere around there. And that Christmas, I got salesperson of the month, right?
Yeah.
But no one taught me. I didn't have any mentors. It was just kind of like me stumbling through the process and just being more aggressive, or more as affable as you could be at 19, have someone believe you that you know anything about selling cars and finance.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so do you consider, you kind of alluded to this earlier, making choices like hiring a coach and listening and learning and being curious Do you consider part of that personality and part of it just serendipity?
You know, somebody said to me recently, and I, as I sit here and think about this conversation, I wonder if this answer is also an answer at different points in my life. But somebody said to me, because they look at the work I do today, where, you know, I'll go into a corporation and we facilitate these 500 person strategic planning summits, which is really radical. It's highly complex. It's innovative. It's at the edge of chaos. And somebody said, they said, you know, the reason that you're doing what you're doing, is because you're ultimately, you're redeeming your soul from your past. I thought, oh my gosh, that sounds deep. I need to go sit with that and figure out what they're actually talking about. But as I thought about it, it reminded me of so many of my peers and my friends who are entrepreneurs of all different types, who I've all heard them say the same thing, that so much of what they eventually got themselves into was just to heal themselves of some challenge that they had of their own, even in a practical sense. So many entrepreneurs I know, they end up designing something to solve a problem that they previously had to live with. So what does this have to do with, you know, why at 17 things had this dramatic turnaround for me? I think one thing, James, is because what we haven't pointed out here is I became in the next year, I was the number one rep in the company. And at that point in time, I was the top rep in the 60-year history of the company out of over a million people who had sold. And I have,
you're like 19.
I was 18. Point, right? Yeah, I was 18. And there's a lot of practical answers that I could give that are real answers to how did I do it? But I think there's almost a deeper like spiritual answer that has to do with that comment that I made a minute ago, which is, you know, I told you that I was in a lot of pain at a certain point in my life. I feel in some ways what drove me and the level of success I had was actually just a very simple response to the equal amount of pain that I was trying to get away from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I think about how dramatically successful I was, I realized that it was only a year and a half before that, that I was having that much pain in my life. So I think that was part of it. There was something deeper there that said I had a lot of motivation to go figure something out. And then the other part of it was one of the first big...
Can I pause right there? Because I actually, you know, it's funny you were saying that. And I just found myself thinking about like just this journey I'm on right now, right? Like writing the leadership book, wanting to talk to you about working with you guys and learning your method and things like that, which we'll talk about in a sec here. But it actually really resonates with me. Is something that no matter where you're at in your life and your journey, I think that's a really fascinating reflective. You know, I'm going to have to probably lose some sleep over this tonight because I'm going to think about it as a way of, well, because I mean, it's a really, for me, I've always struggled to be a leader. Like mm-hmm. I have many of the attributes, I think. But I have never felt like anyone would actually listen to me. Mm. And so I've always been fascinated with leadership and what it is and what it means and how to do it and how to be it and how to teach people to do it. And I think what you just said probably sums up why I'm so interested is that it helps me try to heal something I'm trying to sort out myself. Mm. I think it's a really impactful statement for me. I think that's just, thanks, John. I didn't realize you were going to help me here on this.
That's awesome.
So I think whoever gave you that bit of advice, I mean, that rings true to me at least. So I didn't mean to cut you off.
Speak to that. That's beautiful. Well, I was going to say the other kind of pivotal learning for me from that first mentor of mine, Dan Cassetta, is he had taught me really early on in that business that and there was a little catchphrase we used to always use, and the catchphrase, it had to do with purpose, and the phrase was, when the why is strong enough, the how reveals itself. In other words, you know, when my reasons or my reason for why I'm doing what I'm doing is intense or strong, or then what happens is I'll find a way to accomplish things that I don't have a logical explanation for how I'm going to accomplish it. And what was cool is I got to witness that work for me at 17. Because I sat down with a piece of paper and a pen, and he led me through an exercise. He said, I just want you to fill that this blank piece of paper. I just want you to write down all the reasons why you want to be great in this business. Now, I was a 17-year-old guy, so my answers were, in many cases, very egotistical, superficial, materialistic. What was interesting, though, is that I learned through that exercise, and I kept that piece of paper with me that whole summer. And what was interesting is by the time I'd filled about half the page, I kind of ran out of egotistical reasons why. And I started to have to go beyond just myself. And I started to realize, oh, wow, I could come up with other reasons why this matters. Like, well, who I'm going to become as a person and maybe what I could contribute to the world. But I just to be clear that it took me about 48 other reasons before it was about anybody other than myself.
What are you up to now? Like 15 to 20?
So, yeah, that was kidding. That was a huge learning is the power of connect. And that's actually a big part of the work that we do today. It's that still resonates for me is how important that is for people to understand. Ultimately, to understand that when we ask that question, why? Like, have you heard the parable of the three bricklayers?
No,
we've all not. Okay. So there's three bricklayers, and forgive me for sharing a parable here, but I asked the first bricklayer, why are you doing what you're doing? And he says, well, because it's how I make money. It's how I pay my bills, right? That's his answer. I asked the second bricklayer, and they're working side by side, why are you doing what you're doing? And he says, well, this is the career I'm committed to, and I'm building a building right now. And so right there, you see something that they're doing the same thing, yet they answer, why are you doing this very differently? But then you get to the third bricklayer, and why are you doing what you're doing? And he says, oh, well, I'm doing this because this is my calling. I'm doing this because this building is going to become a church cathedral that's going to connect people closer to their creator. And what I appreciate about that parable is the ending that I made up to it, which is that, so first of all, there's a big observation there in my opinion, which is in that moment when we ask ourselves, why are we doing what we're doing, right? The fundamental purpose question. I think there's a big learning from that parable in that, that it really doesn't have anything to do with what we do in our work. And it has everything to do with how we choose to approach it, that as meaning-making creatures, we proactively, we design, we architect the answer to why we do what we do. And think about it, you know, when I ask those bricklayers, why are you doing what they're doing? When we all ask, why do I do what I do? We have to realize that in that moment, there was nobody forcing an answer upon them, that we have unconditional freedom in how we answer that question. And I feel like I was lucky to learn that at a really young age, that I actually have the freedom to keep asking why and to keep changing my answer until it's one that gives me enough juice that I could run through any wall I want. But then there's a finish to that story, which is why I do what I do today, which is where we'll put an entire organization in a room and we'll ask essentially that question. And the finish to the story is after the third bricklayer said, well, I'm here to build a cathedral. You know what the first guy said? He said, you know, I'd never heard it put that way. But now that I've heard that language and those words, I'm actually going to start thinking about why I go to work a little bit differently. And see, that reminds us of what we call social constructionism, which is that our words create our worlds and our language can be our limits to everything. And so that's why I think it's so important in teams and communities and families for people to have dialogues where everybody shares, well, why am I here? Because their purpose can become each other's purpose. And then crazy things happen when that happens at a large scale. But I got to learn that when I was 17. And how lucky am I?
So I guess my next question is, how long did you do Cutco for?
Did that for about 5 years. 5 years. Yeah.
And why did you leave?
Within that company, I had gotten to at that time what they called the Hall of Fame. So I got inducted into their Hall of Fame as a knife salesman. And it's just hard to say that without smiling.
24?
I was 21 or 22. Yeah. And, I just felt this internal calling that said, okay, this has been the greatest gift I ever could have been given. And I think I need to go see what happens if I bring it out into the world.
You keep using this term size the mission. So, and maybe I missed it, but yeah. What exactly is this mission that you feel like you're on now?
Yeah, it's something that I sense and I feel and I'm witnessing far better than I can articulate it. And that's okay. I had someone ask me recently, what's your plan? I said, I don't have a plan. I said, I got 9 plans, but we're doing okay. We're doing okay by just being open. So my best answer to my mission, because I can't dance around it any longer, to our mission here at Flourishing Leadership Institute, it's really what I said almost an hour ago. It's to continually ask a question, which is, what is it that brings out the best in a human system? What is it that brings out the best in individuals, organizations, communities, society at large? And so that's a big question. And what that's led to is it's brought us into some pretty radical opportunities to impact on a really big scale. So that's that.
So why does that drive you? Like, why does that question drive you?
Yeah, it drives me because I guess there's a couple of reasons. One, because I feel like what I have felt and sensed and seen in the world through my eyes is that the world is at a really critical point in time where what the world is asking for, I don't know if it's asking, but I think what the world would benefit from is a kind of a redefinition or a reinvention of what leadership is. And so that's point number one of why I'm called towards this. Point number two is I feel like I've witnessed firsthand I've had the privilege to be in leadership capacities where in my own clunky way, where I kind of know what I'm doing, I've found a way to make incredible things happen. And I feel like there's some sort of deeper truth to some of these methodologies and approaches that we've been connecting ourselves to, that if we could figure out how to scale up these deeper truths and these new ways of being and knowing, that we could solve some of the biggest opportunities in the world. So that's, I don't know, that's my answer to that.
Clearly have found your why, and now you're trying to put meat on that why.
Yeah.
And move it, you know, to answer other questions. You know, I think one question of why you do what you do leads to other questions of why that's important. Why is it significant for you to do it at this time? You know, I mean, these are all important questions that, because you know what, like as I'm kind of playing back our conversation, and one of your attributes that really sticks out to me is your intuition.
Hmm.
Like you seem to have intuition about the right time to make a choice.
Hmm.
And you fully vest yourself in that choice, but you just back yourself in. Like you're like, I'm doing this. And a lot of that's just intuition. I mean, from this whole entire story from 17, it seems like you've always just kind of trusted your gut. And I'm sure there's times where maybe your gut told you one thing and you did something else. But I mean, overall, major decisions, it seems as if you've kind of always trusted your gut.
Yeah, I guess I have. I guess I have. Yeah. I think one of the things I'm always trying to do is to remain open, to remain open to things that are beyond just what's visible, beyond what's just obvious. So I try and remain open to possibilities that, I've never thought of, to opportunities that, you know, have yet to be articulated, and what's my role? What are my strengths? What are my capabilities? And mm-hmm. I'm constantly asking very practical questions like, okay, what am I good at? And how do I keep sharpening my own understanding of what I'm good at? And when I look at what I'm good at, how can I start to evolve what I'm good at? Like, how can a strength be applied in a different space or industry or environment or setting where all of a sudden that becomes a multiplier, right? It's a combination effect. And really quickly, what that's led me to is realizing, well, it's not about me becoming a superhuman. It's about being around people where collectively the configuration of strengths based on people that I bring in as part of a team, you know, that we can create some incredible future that we'd never thought of. So, I mean, to me, those are just practical questions that I'm trying to ask and find answers to.
All right. Well, listen, I could talk to you for obviously a long time, but I need to get to bed and you have a job. So last question, and I ask this of everybody, and I have a feeling you're going to give me a very thoughtful answer. John, for where you're at and what you do, how do you define happiness?
How do I define happiness? Yeah, you know, I don't define it based on positive emotions alone, at least. I think and I'm just going to borrow here, and this is a great example. My best answer is not my own answer. And I do that a lot. My best answer to that question is really what I've learned from Marty Seligman. And Marty Seligman, as you know, he really gave birth to what I would call the happiness movement back in 1999. You know, all of our bookshelves changed between 2000 and now because of him, because he said, hey, let's stop studying disease. He was the world expert on what's wrong with people. And he said, let's study positive emotions. You know, let's study resilience, right? Things like that. And what I've learned from Marty is that, you know, we put a lot into this idea of happiness, but I really appreciate his perspective that emerged about 5 years ago is that it's about well-being, and that all of us find well-being through one of four or five different ways. And so this is how I would answer that. I would say for me, you know, happiness, it's really more about some configuration of, you know, my emotional state. It's a configuration of how engaged am I in what I'm doing. Like when I go play soccer on Thursday nights in this pickup league, I find a state of flow, right? This optimal state of experience. I'm not giggling and joyful, but I'm in a state of flow that is deeply fulfilling, right? So for me, that's valuable to find ways to be engaged in my life. A third lever might be relationships. And for me, the relationships that really matter to me are my kids. And everybody else is a distant, distant second to that. And my wife is there with my kids. So I get a lot of joy from that. And then the fourth lever for me for happiness would be is meaning and purpose in my life. And I feel fortunate that I was taught a long time ago that I have unconditional freedom over how I answer the question, why am I doing what I'm doing? Those are the things that get me, you know, that personal sense of well-being, I guess.
Well, John Berghoff, thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
Dr. James, it's great, buddy. I appreciate it, man. You can do whatever you want. Just believe it. Believe it. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. Just believe it. Believe it. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. Just live it. Believe it. You can do whatever.